Lowe's early Black Friday deals are going fast. Don't miss up to 50% off select major appliances. Plus, up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. And with Christmas around the corner, you're going to need more string lights, right? Save $4 on GE LED 100-count string lights, now just $5.98. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 12/3. Selection varies by location. Select locations only while supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Welcome to The Deep Dive. If you're looking for the shortcut to being the smartest person in the room, you've come to the right place.
Today we are strapping on our coconut halves and engaging in a full-scale exploration of the six men who formed Monty Python.
We're taking a deep dive into the source materials detailing the history, the anarchic style, and the truly, well, staggering cultural influence of this British comedy troupe.
It's a mission to unpack the unpackable, really. Trying to define or categorize Python's genius is exactly what they actively sought to prevent, yet their influence now is just, you know, undeniable.
It is. We are looking at how Graham Chapman, John Cleese, Terry Gilliam, Eric Idle, Terry Jones, and Michael Palin came together, threw away the rules of television comedy, and essentially became what many have dubbed, and the sources confirm this analogy, the Beatles of comedy.
That analogy is, I think, perfect, because we're not just talking about six funny men. We're talking about a phenomenon that fundamentally reshaped how we think about comedy structure.
Absolutely. They went from a niche, surreal BBC program to a global cultural touchstone that literally shaped the vocabulary of the internet, influenced major software engineers, and even financed British cinema classics.
And to understand this revolutionary outcome, we have to start at the genesis, the crucial collisions that created the circus.
So we have six brilliant minds, but they weren't exactly a unified group initially, were they? The formative years show a clear geographic and academic split based on where they went to university.
That's right. That famed Oxbridge divide is key here. Comedy in post-war Britain was, well, it was heavily dominated by the output of these two institutions.
Right.
On the Oxford University side, we had Terry Jones and Michael Palin. They worked together in the Oxford Review, which tended to favor slightly more whimsical, visual, and sometimes historical forms of satire.
And on the other side, at Cambridge University, you had the trio of Graham Chapman, John Cleese, and Eric Idle. They were all members of the famed Footlights Club.
The Footlights was, and still is, an absolute crucible of comedic talent. At that time, it was producing a kind of intellectual, highly verbal, and often very political satire.
And not just them. The sources note that this group also included people who would go on to be part of the Goodies, right?
Yeah, exactly. People like Tim Brooke Taylor and Bill Oddie, plus Jonathan Lynn, who co-wrote the hugely successful political satire Yes Minister. So you had two very different, highly fertile environments feeding into what would become the Python machine.
And the person who was the connective tissue to the New World, the only non-British Python, Terry Gilliam, he met one of the others in a really unexpected location.
Precisely. The critical initial meeting between John Cleese and Terry Gilliam happened not in a, you know, damp BBC office, but in New York City.
Wow.
Cleese was touring America with the Cambridge University Footlights Review, which was called Cambridge Circus. Gilliam, who was this American animator and cartoonist, was in the audience. They met, they talked, and, well, the seed was planted for the visual collaboration that would define Python.
But before Python, the sources all point to a critical staging post that united the British members, a pivotal satirical show on the BBC.
The Frost Report.
The Frost Report, yeah. Running from 1966 to 1967, why was this show so essential?
It's crucial because it was the first time the majority of the team were in the same room, working together professionally under, you know, immense pressure. Cleese was a cast member and writer. Idle, Chapman, Palin, and Jones were all writers on the program.
So it forced them to interact, to collaborate, and to test their writing styles against each other.
It did. And it was a very traditional sketch show, but it was highly political and focused on class satire, something deeply prevalent in British culture at the time.
Cleese often pointed out that the show helped them understand the structure of comedy they wanted to eventually destroy, didn't he?
That's the key. In the Frost Report, every sketch had a clear beginning, middle, and a punchline. It taught them the rules of establishment comedy.
So they learned the language of the enemy before launching their attack.
Exactly. They saw the limitations of that predictable format. But they didn't jump directly from Frost to Python. We see the group splitting into those two main factions for these midpoint collaborations.
Right. So Chapman and Cleese were working on the highly formal but absurd at last, the 1948 show.
And then you had the other faction, the three who would later drive the more visual and surreal side of Python, Idle, Jones, and Palin.
They worked together on a children's program called Do Not Adjust Your Set. And Gilliam provided animation for that show.
Which was so important because, being a children's show, it allowed them greater freedom to experiment with non-sequiturs and breaking the rules of narrative, precisely because the expectation was lower. They were honing that distinct brand of British surreal satire outside the strictures of primetime adult comedy.
Now, we arrive at the actual and rather chaotic formation of the troupe. It wasn't an intentional artistic gathering, was it? It was more a result of conflicting television contracts and, well, personal management.
You are absolutely right. The sources depict a chaotic situation driven by television deal-making. Thames Television offered a late-night show to the Do Not Adjust Your Set group. So, Idle, Jones, Palin, and Gilliam.
And at the same time, the BBC, eager to capitalize on this satirical talent pool, offered a show to the duo of Cleese and Chapman.
So they were on the verge of becoming two separate comedy groups.
What was the pivotal shift that forced them all together?
It hinged entirely on John Cleese's deep reluctance to do a two-man show with Chapman. Cleese cited Chapman's difficult and erratic personality.
Which was due partly to Chapman's struggles with alcoholism at the time, right?
Yes, and it made their isolated working dynamic challenging. Cleese had much fonder memories of his collaboration with Palin on other short-lived projects, like How to Irritate People.
So Cleese extended the invitation to Palin, looking for a reliable collaborator, and Palin, in turn, acted as the vital conduit.
He did. Palin invited his writing partner Terry Jones, plus Eric Idle, who then insisted that Terry Gilliam be brought in to provide the crucial revolutionary animations.
So it really was Cleese's desire to work with Palin, bypassing Chapman's perceived unreliability, coupled with a lot of opportune scheduling, that brought all six members into the fold.
It's amazing how high-stakes career decisions often boil down to personal chemistry and, you know, convenience.
And the sources pinpoint the specific, rather mundane birthplace of this cultural revolution.
They do. It was a meeting at a Kashmir Tandoori restaurant in Hampstead on the 11th of May, 1969. That's where the group solidified the concept and hammered out the terms of their collaboration with the BBC.
And then came the hard part, naming the show. They were unified in wanting a completely nonsensical title, feeling it would be inherently funnier if the title had absolutely nothing to do with the content. It was a sort of anti-marketing stance.
Oh, the list of rejected names is a comedy sketch in itself. They truly sought titles that were absurdly academic or utterly meaningless, like Owl Stretching Time.
And the Toad Elevating Moment. I also saw A Horse, A Spoon, and A Basin and Bun, Wacket, Buzzard, Stubble, and Boot.
It's just brilliant. The one that actually stuck, Flying Circus, only did so, quite hilariously, because the BBC had already printed the name in their schedules.
And in classic bureaucratic fashion, they just refused to amend the broadcast listings.
They were semi-forced into that part of the name due to BBC inertia.
Mm-hmm.
But the Monty Python part was deliberate, and it's a brilliant window into their slightly sleazy sensibility.
So what's the full story behind Monty, then?
Eric Idle is consistently credited with the idea for Monty. There are two conflicting accounts from the team, both of which Idle seemed happy to encourage.
Okay.
One version suggests it was a gently mocking tribute to Field Marshal Lord Montgomery, the famously rotund and bombastic British general during WWII.
And the other.
The other, perhaps more Python-esque, suggests it was the name of a popular rotund fellow at Idle's local pub, a character whose name sounded comically pompous, but was actually quite ordinary.
Either way, the final name, Monty Python, was ultimately chosen because the team envisaged it as the perfect name for a sleazy entertainment agent. It's that blend of the high and the low.
A perfect encapsulation of their methodology. They started as a group of highly educated Oxbridge grads trying to invent a new kind of surreal humor. And they named themselves after a hypothetical sleazy entertainment agent. They were challenging the establishment, even with their own branding.
With the name settled, we jump straight into Monty Python's Flying Circus, which ran from 1969 to 1974. The show instantly became a landmark in the evolution of television. It didn't just bend the existing rules of sketch comedy, it actively sought to, well, vaporize them entirely.
The show was defined by its loosely structured stream of consciousness approach, but the single most revolutionary element, the one that broke the entire mold, was their anti-punchline philosophy.
This is such a critical, game-changing concept. They perceived a weakness in comedy where a strong, funny sketch was often completely ruined or killed by a weak or predictable ending.
Forcing a kind of narrative closure that wasn't deserved. So their solution was to just discard the traditional ending altogether. They would simply cut abruptly to an unrelated scene, or a character would walk off stage, break the fourth wall.
Or introduce a completely irrelevant event, usually through Terry Gilliam's animation.
Right. John Cleese famously captured this intellectual argument in an early episode, turning to Eric Idle mid-chaos and remarking, "This is the silliest sketch I've ever been in." And then they just walked off the set.
That moment isn't just a joke. It's an intellectual critique of comedy structure delivered as a joke. But was this level of anarchy entirely new in British TV? The sources cite a major, immediate influence that pushed Python to be even more innovative.
They were undoubtedly spurred on by Spike Milligan's concurrent BBC series, Q, which also premiered in 1969. Milligan's show was already deeply irreverent and highly anarchic. He would sometimes just give up on sketches or appear to lose interest.
So Python wasn't the first to be anarchic, but they kind of professionalized the chaos.
Exactly. Terry Jones, in particular, was vocal about this competition, stating that Python had to innovate and be even more groundbreaking than Milligan, refining the chaos into an actual style. They institutionalized the anarchy.
Beyond just abandoning the punchline, they popularized formal techniques that TV now takes for granted. The cold open, now ubiquitous in prestige drama and comedy, was a Python staple.
Their iconic cold open featured Michael Palin, often decked out in Robinson Crusoe gear, making a difficult, lengthy journey just to approach the camera and declare, "It's said," only to be immediately cut off by the title sequence.
They sometimes even ran the closing credits halfway through the show, didn't they?
They did. Followed by Cleese parodying a clipped BBC announcer over the familiar Globe logo, tricking the viewers into thinking the episode was over. This intentional subversiveness made the audience realize they could never trust the structure of the show.
And the sources are clear. This anti-authoritarianism wasn't just stylistic, it was thematic.
Cleese stated, "Anti-authoritarianism was deeply ingrained in Python. Their targets were almost always institutions, middle-class norms, bureaucracy, pomposity, and the restrictive nature of the media itself. By constantly undermining the medium they were working in, they were delivering a meta-critique of the establishment."
The genius of Python wasn't just the writing. Since they deliberately fragmented the narrative flow, they desperately needed a mechanism to connect those disparate ideas. That's where Terry Gilliam's surreal stop-motion animation becomes the absolutely essential glue.
The stream of consciousness style was primarily driven by the Jones, Palin, and Gilliam faction, who relied on the animation to move seamlessly between unrelated concepts.
Gilliam's style was so distinctive. Stop-motion collage created using scissors, an airbrush, and images lifted directly from famous art and Victorian engravings.
Juxtaposing highbrow historical visuals with absurd modern concepts.
And the visual trademark that every single person associates with the show's opening credits, that giant crushing foot, is actually a piece of art history itself, which is a perfect metaphor for their whole approach.
It's the foot of Cupid, specifically cut from a reproduction of the Renaissance masterpiece, Venus, Cupid, Folly, and Time by Bronzino.
By taking a piece of classical revered art and turning it into a cartoonish destructive force, Gilliam visually articulated their intent to satirize and crush artistic pomposity.
Absolutely. And if they didn't cut away or use animation, the Pythons had other highly specific recurring methods of stopping a sketch dead in its tracks.
Like the anti-silliness character.
Right. Graham Chapman, utilizing his freight man persona, played the Colonel, who would march into a sketch, usually while it was devolving into complete chaos, and order it to be stopped because things were becoming far too silly.
Or they'd use a physical, cartoonish interruption.
Exactly. A knight in full armor, often played by Gilliam himself, would wander onto the set and simply hit characters over the head with a rubber chicken, thereby concluding the argument and the sketch simultaneously.
But the most quoted non-sketch line, the transition that became iconic, was that famous clipped phrase uttered by John Cleese, and now for something completely different.
It became the title of their first film, cementing its status as an iconic part of their style. It was the verbal equivalent of Gilliam's smashing foot, a polite way of signaling utter deliberate disruption.
Let's talk about the theme music, John Philip Sousa's The Liberty Bell. I always assumed they chose it because it sounded suitably bombastic and ridiculous, but there's a great surprising financial footnote here.
There is. The bombast was part of the joke, yes. But Gilliam, having been published in the United States, was aware of U.S. copyright laws. He chose the Liberty Bell specifically because, having been published prior to 1924, it was in the public domain under U.S. copyright law.
So no royalties.
No royalties required for its use, which was a huge factor for a low-budget, highly experimental BBC show. It was a major financial win hidden beneath a silly martial tune, a true Python-esque solution.
Moving on to the actual meat of the comedy, the iconic sketches that define them, we have Dead Parrot, a masterpiece of verbal aggression satirizing the utter absurdity of poor customer service.
And of course, the Ministry of Silly Walks, an absurd, brilliant take on bureaucratic inefficiency. Cleese's character demanding money to invent increasingly ridiculous walks is a direct assault on the perceived wastefulness of government departments.
In Spam, the sketch itself is simple. A couple tries to order breakfast, only to find that every single menu item includes Spam.
It was a brilliant satire on the ubiquity of canned meat post-World War II Britain. We'll definitely discuss the incredible linguistic legacy of that specific sketch later.
You also had Four Yorkshiremen, which parodied those nostalgic conversations about humble beginnings, spinning them into competitive tales of hardship that grew exponentially absurd.
A surprising, enduring visual component of Python's humor comes from the simple act of cross-dressing. They maintained a long British tradition of men playing female roles themselves.
Speaking in falsetto or just donning a dress and a hat.
This was a key part of their visual style. Terry Jones was the undisputed specialist here, often playing the working-class housewife, or what the BBC themselves termed the rat-bag old women.
Palin and Idle would often play the more posh or middle-class women, providing a different class flavor. Was there a specific reason they preferred to play the female roles themselves?
They felt they were better at being funny in those parts than the available actresses at the time, particularly because they didn't require the women to be traditionally attractive, allowing them to focus entirely on the absurdity of the character.
But when the role absolutely required the character to be conventionally attractive, they would turn to a professional actress.
Which brings us to Carol Cleveland, the essential collaborator often described as the unofficial seventh member of the troupe.
She was the most important female performer in the ensemble, appearing in about two-thirds of the episodes in all the films.
She was initially hired for just 5 episodes, but the Pythons lobbied for her permanent inclusion after they found that other actresses brought in by the director were struggling to grasp their specific rapid and surreal timing.
Python's global success wasn't instantaneous outside the UK, but it certainly began early. They broke into North America via the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, the CBC, in 1970.
And the Canadian reaction was immediate and passionate. When the CBC temporarily dropped the show in 1971, they received hundreds of calls complaining, and over 100 people actually staged a protest at the CBC's Montreal studios.
Wow. The American breakthrough was considerably slower, though. Their first feature film, and now for something completely different, didn't do that well initially.
No, the real catalyst was public television, specifically Ron DeVillier, the programming director for Kira in Dallas, Texas. He began airing the episodes in the summer of 1974.
And the response was immediate and surprising for a highbrow, surreal British import.
The ratings shot through the roof in Dallas. This success prompted other PDS affiliates to pick up the show, which led to the creation of the famed British Comedy Night that became a staple of PBS stations across the country.
This unexpected U.S. success, however, led to a famous and crucial legal battle that set a landmark precedent for artists' rights, which we have to explore.
This is the critical case of Gilliam v. American Broadcasting Companies, Inc. ABC, recognizing the show's popularity, broadcast 2 90-minute specials of Python material. But they heavily edited the content.
They cut a total of 24 minutes, right? Partly for commercials, but also to remove what they called scatological references.
Exactly. They were essentially destroying the flow and artistic integrity of the work to fit commercial sensibilities. The Pythons, led by Terry Gilliam, sued.
And the core argument was that the edits fundamentally distorted their artistic vision and damaged their reputation.
And they won. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit ruled in Python's favor. It was a huge defining moment for creative control. It established that artists could legally defend their work against mutilation.
It was a statement. Python was not just content, it was art. They won the right to preserve their intentional anarchy.
After that, their global reach just expanded. In 1976, Python was the top-rated show in Japan. And in a charming modern tribute, the town of Spijkenisse in the Netherlands opened a Silly Walks road crossing in 2018. The absurdity they championed has literally been written into the civic landscape.
So we've established the style, but the real magic and the inevitable friction lay in the synergy between the six members. Let's talk about how they worked and what ultimately fractured the Flying Circus itself.
The structure of their collaboration was based on three distinct writing factions, and the tension between them provided a wide dynamic range of comedic styles.
Let's break down the three units. First, you had the pair of Cleese and Chapman.
They typically worked in isolation. Their humor was highly verbal, often aggressive, and centered on confrontations. The perpetually frustrated bureaucrat, the customer service nightmare. It was all about the precision of the dialogue.
Then you had the face-to-face team of Jones and Palin.
Their sessions were highly collaborative, characterized by laughter and a strong focus on shared ideas. Their work tended to be more visual, more fanciful, often involving historical satire.
And finally, Eric Idle, the third faction, who famously wrote entirely solo.
Idle was the master of wordplay, the self-described, ludicrously overliterate writer whose work leaned into long-form monologues, parodies, and crucially, musical numbers. Gilliam, as the animator, acted as the vital, unifying bridge connecting these three disparate universes.
Despite the successful collaboration, the television series couldn't last forever. John Cleese made the pivotal decision to depart after Series 3 in 1974. Why did he step away?
He felt creatively drained, a sense of diminishing returns. He was very open later about this, claiming that only two sketches written by him and Chapman in that third series, Dennis Moore and The Tree Shop, were genuinely original.
So it was a principled departure rooted in a desire not to compromise their innovation.
Absolutely. He sought a more disciplined form of comedy, which he would later find in Fawlty Towers. He also cited the strain of working with Chapman, who was struggling significantly with alcohol dependence at the time.
The remaining five members decided to push on for one final shorter season, a six-episode half season. How did they manage without Cleese?
They shifted their dynamic, giving Jones, Palin, and Idle more space. While Cleese was gone as a performer, he was actually credited as a writer for three of those six episodes, which is often forgotten.
Let's talk about Graham Chapman. He's perhaps the most complex figure in the group. He often anchored the most surreal sketches by playing the absolute straight man.
And he had a fascinating background, having originally been a medical student at Cambridge and was legally entitled to practice as a doctor.
In the films, he took the absolute lead roles.
He did. He was King Arthur in Holy Grail and the titular Brian Cohen in Life of Brian. He possessed a unique stillness that made the absurd dialogue around him land harder.
Cleese considered him his most essential writing partner, despite their difficulties.
Cleese often described Chapman as his greatest sounding board. Cleese said, if Graham thought something was funny, then it almost certainly was funny. You cannot believe how invaluable that is.
Sadly, Chapman's life was cut short by metastatic throat cancer in 1989. The ensuing memorial service, however, remains one of the most famous, darkly irreverent moments in the group's history.
John Cleese delivered the eulogy. He began by famously claiming he was the first person in history to say the forbidden word at a British memorial service. And then he delivered an utterly irreverent yet profound tribute.
He used the opportunity to recycle every single euphemism for being dead from the dead parrot sketch, right?
Yes. He declared Chapman was no more, that he had ceased to be, that he had expired and gone to meet his maker. It was a fittingly absurdist tribute to his partner.
John Cleese is known for his signature style of highly verbal, often abusive, and intimidating humor. But his career truly dominated British comedy beyond Python.
Absolutely. His BBC sitcom Fawlty Towers, which he co-wrote with his then-wife Connie Booth, is a landmark achievement. It is the only comedy series to ever rank higher than Monty Python's Flying Circus on the BFI TV 100 list, topping the entire poll.
That show took Cleese's Python persona, the man perpetually on the verge of a nervous breakdown, and gave him a sustained environment to explore that rage.
It was Python's high-pressure, formal confrontation humor, but contained and sharpened. His solo film success cemented his status as a mainstream writer and comedic actor. He wrote the screenplay for A Fish Called Wanda, starring alongside Michael Palin, earning an Oscar nomination.
Terry Jones was often characterized as the heart of Python. Why that specific description?
He was crucial for maintaining unity and creative independence. Where Cleese pushed for tighter verbal structure, Jones, often working with Palin, pushed for greater visual anarchy and fantasy. The friction between their two styles was essential.
And his most significant contributions were arguably behind the camera, driving the feature films.
Precisely. Jones solely directed Life of Brian and The Meaning of Life, having co-directed Holy Grail with Gilliam. Jones was the one most insistent on giving the films a narrative flow.
And yet, despite his directorial prowess, his most famous moment is often cited as a performance role.
Indeed. He delivered arguably the most famous single line in all of Python history in his iconic cross-dressing role as Brian's mother, Mandy, in Life of Brian. He's not the Messiah. He's a very naughty boy.
Terry Gilliam is the unique American member of the troupe who actually renounced his U.S. citizenship in 2006.
He started as an animator and strip cartoonist, crucial for bridging the disparate sketches and provided the iconic visuals. He was the visual director, the one who translated the linguistic chaos into something audiences could actually see flowing from one absurd idea to the next.
He co-directed Holy Grail with Jones, but that co-directing role didn't last into the later features. Why the separation?
Gilliam and Jones had different directorial philosophies. Gilliam had a penchant for elaborate set pieces and visual ambition, whereas Jones preferred a faster pace focused on character dialogue. For the later films, Jones insisted on solo directing.
But Gilliam's solo career as a live-action director turned him into a visual auteur in his own right.
Films like Brazil, which is a monumental vision of dystopia and featured Michael Palin, and Time Bandits, which Gilliam co-wrote with Palin, established him internationally. He has a prolific career that grew directly out of his Python visual sensibility.
Eric Idle was the third faction, working solo and specializing in elaborate wordplay and, critically, his musical numbers. He wrote classics like The Galaxy Song and Always Look on the Bright Side of Life.
Idle's work, much like Gilliam's, served as a crucial change of pace, moving the show into territory the other writers rarely trod. He was the one who could stop the sketch and start a fully orchestrated, witty song.
Idle utilized this musical inclination later in life, resulting in a phenomenal success that makes him, according to all financial metrics, the most financially successful of the entire troupe.
That success is the Tony Award-winning musical Spamalot, based on Holy Grail. It has been an enormous, decade-spanning hit. Its financial success far outstripped the earnings of the original films.
He followed that up with Not the Messiah, an oratorio based on Life of Brian.
The sources confirmed that Idle's ability to take the Python ethos and translate it successfully into a mainstream theatrical format has generated revenue that sustains the rest of the members to this day.
While the six men were the core, the seventh Python title has been thrown around for years, but two names stand out with the most meaningful contributions.
Those are Neil Innes and Carol Cleveland. Let's start with Neil Innes, who was both a writer and a musician within their orbit.
Innes is the only non-Python besides Douglas Adams credited with writing material for Flying Circus. He appeared in several films and sketches, and crucially, he wrote all the music for Idle's seminal Beatles parody mockumentary, The Ruddles.
He was the essential musical voice supporting Idle. And then there is Carol Cleveland, the Python girl. She was indispensable for two-thirds of the episodes in all the films.
She was the most important female performer, playing roles that ranged from the beautiful maiden to the straight foil in sketches. She was vital because she was a professional actress who understood how to be the anchor.
And we must mention the brief but notable contribution of the future science fiction titan, Douglas Adams.
Adams earned one writing credit in the final five-member series for a sketch called Patient Abuse, which satirized mind-boggling bureaucracy.
He got the job during Cleese's absence from the final season, forming a short-lived writing partnership with Chapman. The satire of bureaucratic indifference was strong enough to slot seamlessly into their established style.
The feature films proved that their surreal style could translate effectively to the big screen, allowing them to move beyond simply reshot sketches and into grand-scale satire.
Their first attempt, and now for something completely different in 1971, was simply reshot sketches. It failed initially at the box office, though it later found cult success. The Pythons themselves didn't consider it a true artistic success.
Their first true narrative feature was Monty Python and the Holy Grail in 1975. This film is legendary, not only for its low-tech satire, but also for its ridiculously low budget. Just £229,000. And the surprising way they raised the money.
It's an iconic rock and roll footnote. The financing came partly from investments by major rock groups of the era. We're talking about bands like Pink Floyd, Jethro Tull, and Led Zeppelin.
The necessity of saving money contributed directly to the humor. They couldn't afford real horses, so they used coconuts. It delivered enduring lines that had become absorbed into global pop culture, like the Black Knight's hilariously defiant "Tis but a scratch."
Next came Monty Python's Life of Brian in 1979. This film generated massive religious controversy, but the Pythons were always clear about their target. Not Christ, but his followers.
I think we need to emphasize that distinction, as it was at the heart of their defense.
The pythons agreed beforehand not to mock Jesus or his teachings directly. Instead, the film is a brilliant, surgical satire on credulity, blind devotion, and hypocrisy among the followers of Brian Cohen, a man who is constantly mistaken for the Messiah.
And who financed this controversial project when others, spooked by the script, pulled out.
George Harrison, the former Beatle. He formed Handmade Films specifically to raise the £4 million necessary to produce the movie, later calling it the most expensive cinema ticket ever purchased.
What's fascinating is the retrospective intellectual defense of the film.
Noted theologian Richard Burridge called Life of Brian an extraordinary tribute to Jesus, arguing that the pythons were actually satirizing blind fundamentalism and the way people quickly split into factions, a theme that remains perpetually relevant.
Their last collaborative project was 1983's Monty Python's The Meaning of Life. It returned to the sketch format, loosely following the Ages of Man.
It was arguably their darkest and most visually spectacular work. It featured the morbidly obese Mr. Creosote exploding over restaurant patrons and the liver donor scene, which satirized bureaucracy in a medical setting.
And they achieved critical recognition for this darkness.
They did. The Meaning of Life won the Grand Prix at the 1983 Cannes Film Festival, marking their artistic swan song as a unified film unit.
Beyond their own creative output, the Python members used their enormous fame to raise serious awareness for international human rights, particularly through the Secret Policeman's Ball benefit shows for Amnesty International, which was John Cleese's brainchild.
Between 1976 and 1981, these shows raised considerable funds and, crucially, media awareness for the human rights cause. They transformed the perception of Amnesty International, bringing its serious issues to a younger, massive audience.
And the cultural influence of these shows extended far beyond the comedy world, right? It directly impacted rock music and subsequent global activism.
It's very direct. Bono of U2 told Rolling Stone that seeing the ball sowed a seed that became a part of him and U2's advocacy work. Sting explicitly credited the show with informing him about Amnesty.
And Bob Geldof, the organizer of Live Aid, famously took the ball and ran with it, according to Sting, modeling his massive charity rock concerts on the successful platform Python had established.
It's incredible to connect Python's early anarchy to the biggest global charity efforts of the 80s and 90s.
The speculation over a complete reunion ended definitively with Graham Chapman's death in 1989. However, the remaining five members did gather on several non-formal occasions.
The 1998 reunion live at Aspen was particularly notable. That was the time when they were reunited on stage with what was purported to be Chapman's ashes, a bizarre moment that culminated in Eric Idle scattering them dramatically over the audience.
But the eventual, truly final reunion was driven by less artistic motives and more direct financial necessity.
It was a direct consequence of a lost legal battle in 2013. They lost a lawsuit over royalties for Spamalot and owed a massive combined sum of £800,000 in legal fees and back royalties. To pay this monumental bill, they proposed a live reunion show.
And the demand proved just how enduring their popularity was.
Tickets for the first O2 Arena show in London sold out in a mind-boggling 43 seconds. 9 additional shows were quickly added, resulting in Monty Python Live. Mostly. 1 down, 5 to go.
Michael Palin stated unequivocally that the final performance on July 20th, 2014 would be the last time the troupe would ever perform together, and that final show was screened live to 2,000 cinemas globally.
Idle commented on the scale of the moment, noting that the Pythons got the massive global public final bow that the Beatles didn't get. It was a final unifying moment for a group defined by disruption.
So what does this all mean for comedy and culture today? They started by trying to demolish the existing structure of British culture, yet they grew into an enduring institution.
The key to their institutional status lies in the very nature of their surreal humor. The term Pythonesque has officially entered standard dictionaries as a byword for surreal, absurd, often satirical humor.
That is the ultimate, delicious irony, which Terry Jones himself acknowledged. He claims the very existence of the word Pythonesque proves the extent to which they failed, as their initial aim was to create something so new it would be impossible to categorize.
Instead, they just created a new category. And that successful failure defines modern comedy. The list of comedians who cite Python as a major influence is a who's who. Mike Myers, Jim Carrey, Tina Fey, and Matt Groening, the creator of The Simpsons.
And the most important structural lesson they passed on, according to Tina Fey, it wasn't the jokes, it was the structure. She pointed out that sketch endings are overrated. Their key was to do something as long as it was funny and then just stop and do something else.
That anti-punchline philosophy became standard operating procedure. Their influence directly colored the work of the early editions of Saturday Night Live, leading to shows like Kids in the Hall, and continues through to modern shows like South Park.
Let's move beyond comedy into the surprising reach of their influence, technology, and science. We're talking about things that bear the Python name that have nothing to do with comedy, but everything to do with their cultural absorption.
Let's start with the one that affects all of our daily lives. Spam. The universally used term for bulk, unsolicited email is derived directly from the 1970 spam sketch.
Explain the connection again. Why did this particular sketch lend its name to junk mail?
In the sketch, a chorus of Vikings drowns out all conversation by aggressively and repeatedly singing spam, 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 spam. The idea is that the content is overwhelming, unavoidable, and drowns out anything meaningful.
That's phenomenal. A satire of ubiquitous canned meat became the technical descriptor for ubiquitous junk mail. But the biggest scientific tribute involves one of the world's most popular programming languages.
Yes. The Python programming language was named after the troop by its creator, Guido Van Rossum. He wanted a name that was slightly playful and memorable.
And the tributes within the coding world don't stop there.
Not at all. The default integrated development environment is named IDLE in honor of Eric Idle. The package index is called the Cheese Shop. There's a refactoring tool called Bicycle Repair. And a project to merge Python with Perl was dubbed Parrot, after the dead parrot sketch.
The sheer number of scientific and celestial namesakes is staggering.
7 asteroids are named after the Pythons, or the troop, including 9617 Graham Chapman and 13681 Monty Python. They're literally written into the solar system.
And terrestrially, we have 2 remarkable biological tributes. An endangered lemur found in Madagascar is named Avahi Cleesi after John Cleese.
Cleese was very happy about this, often joking that he was finally being recognized for being a primate. And a gigantic prehistoric snake fossil discovered in Australia was given the taxonomic name Monypythonoids riverslansis.
Even geneticists are fans.
A mutant gene discovered in flies that makes them live longer was dubbed INDI, which is an acronym for the famous defiant line of dialogue from Holy Grail. I'm not dead yet.
Finally, the Pythons weren't afraid to use their institutional status for large-scale, ridiculous public performance and world records.
In 2007, the cast of Spamalot gathered in Trafalgar Square under the tutelage of the 2 Terrys, Jones and Gilliam, to attempt a record for the largest coconut orchestra.
They led 5,567 people clip-clopping in time to Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. And in 2019, to mark the 50th anniversary, they attempted a world record for the largest gathering of people dressed as Dumbies.
Those characters of limited intelligence known for yelling, "My brain hurts."
A truly fitting way to celebrate 50 years of institutionalized absurdity. So we've traced the history from the Oxbridge rivalry to their massive, unexpected impact on social activism and technology. They discarded the traditional rules of sketch comedy, replacing them with a style so distinct it earned its own dictionary entry.
What stands out, and what allowed this enduring genius to flourish, is the fact that the Pythons insisted on and secured complete creative control from the very start. They had BBC executives who, though initially confused, ultimately let them experiment and innovate wildly.
And this raises an important question for you, the listener, to consider. In our current age of high commercial optimization, audience metrics, and immediate social media feedback, could a brand new, highly surreal comedy troupe today secure the same level of total, hands-off freedom from executives to be as anarchic and uncategorizable as Monty Python was in the late 60s and early 70s?
Or was their perfect, permissive timing as crucial to their success as their undeniable genius?
That is definitely something completely different to think about. Until next time, keep digging and always remember to look on the bright side of life.